Over NBC's coast-to-coast network of independent and affiliated stations, the University of Chicago Roundtable, we present Robert Horn of the Department of Political Science of the University of Chicago. Mr. Horn.
I am a Republican, and I am disturbed about the future of the Republican Party. After the shock of the election, I am beginning to wonder, like millions of others, what the future holds for the Republican Party or whether it has any future. This year marked the fifth consecutive defeat for Republican presidential candidates. This presidential election was the closest one since 1916. But Governor Dewey in 1948 received fewer votes than he got in 1944, although more votes were cast this year than in 1944. And Republican congressional candidates generally ran below Dewey this year. In fact, Governor Dewey received only 600,000 votes more than Herbert Hoover received in 1928, although there are many million more potential and actual voters now than there were 20 years ago. Moreover, this fifth consecutive defeat means that the Republicans, by 1952, will have been out of the White House for the longest time that either the Democrats or the Republicans have been out of power since the end of the Civil War. The Republicans can no longer claim to be the majority party of the country. Many people are saying that unless the Republican Party changes, it will die. If I were a Democrat, I would also be disturbed about the future of the Republican Party. Joining me in this discussion is Senator Raymond E. Baldwin, Republican of Connecticut, and Senator Ralph E. Flanders, Republican of Vermont. Senator Flanders, why should all Americans be concerned about the future of the Republican Party?
Mr. Horn, all Americans, whether affiliated with the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, should be concerned. In fact, I was interested the other day to have one of the Democratic senators, whom we all respect, state in so many words his concern for the strength of the Republican Party. And the reasons he was concerned are reasons which must affect us all. That is that the continuation of Democratic government depends on there being two strong parties. It depends on the bipartisan government. We see the reverse of that in European governments, which are splintered up into small parties and which govern themselves with difficulty and without real success by transient combinations of these splinters. We can't do it that way.
Senator Baldwin, do you feel that this election threatens the successful functioning of the two-party system?
It does, Mr. Horn, unless the Republican Party meets the challenge of this particular time. It depends upon whether or not the Republican Party measures up to its responsibility as to whether or not it's going to continue to exist as a party and preserve the two-party system. I think that's one of its great opportunities now. Any minority party, as a matter of policy, of course, faces a number of possibilities. In our case, we could deny the need to deal with high prices, for example, or housing, or health, or education, or reclamation, or we could simply oppose all proposals coming from the other party, either claiming that they will not work, or that they are too costly, or that they are too socialistic. Or we could outbid the other party. For example, if the Democrats offer public housing to rent at $50 a month, we Republicans could offer it to rent at $25 a month. I reject all of these proposals, but I do say that now is a time for us to make a reappraisal of our party, to build it into a vehicle for the political expression of 22 million Americans and as many more as we can attract to it. And I think with a positive approach to this thing that we can attract more than 22 million.
Senator Baldwin, I take it that you're very clear that the Republican Party must reorganize and become a liberal party. Senator Flanders, would you agree with that stand?
I agree with that thoroughly. I would want to specify a little bit what we mean by a Republican-liberal party and Republican-liberal policy. It means that the legislation we propose and support must be directed toward human ends. But it also means that the methods that we propose for attaining those human ends must be methods which will work.
One of the ways in which the party must examine how it can become liberal is to look at the lessons of this past election and to see what they hold for the future of the party. To answer that question, we are privileged to present Representative Clifford Hope, Congressman from Kansas and Chairman of the House Committee on Agriculture. To present Congressman Hope, we take you now to Kansas City, Missouri. Mr. Hope.
What the Republican Party should do now is a timely subject for discussion, and I suppose most of us have recovered sufficiently by this time to come out of the cyclone cellar and at least take a look around. About the best comment I heard on the election was that of the man who said the Republicans had accomplished the hitherto unheard-of feat of snatching defeat right out of the jaws of victory. Well, it was just about that way, and it seems to me the first question to be answered is, why did we lose? That's always important, but it's particularly so this time because we lost when all the signs indicated a walkaway. Something serious went wrong. Was it the ticket, the platform, or the way the campaign was conducted? I think we had a strong ticket. We had a fine platform. And it seems to me, and I think to most people, that the main reason we lost was because we made the wrong kind of a campaign. It was conducted from the beginning on the theory that a majority of the people of this country had already made up their minds to vote Republican and would not change. That's quite different from the theory we've always gone on in Kansas, that the election wasn't over until the polls closed. But it seemed to be working in this campaign. And what I'm saying now in criticism is pure Monday morning quarterbacking. Anybody can look back now and point out a lot of mistakes. But if you analyze them, they all stem back to the one fault of overconfidence. If this is true, then our failure was due principally to overconfidence and the mistakes which it inspired. And the problem is then not nearly so great as it would have been if we had failed because our fundamental policies were wrong and our candidates were not well qualified. Furthermore, while it is discouraging to have lost, especially under the circumstances, yet those who are mourning or maybe celebrating the demise of the Republican Party are a little premature. It is far from dead, and it has recovered in the past from far worse blows. It seems to me there are three things, among others, which should be done soon. First, determine the policy which the party will follow in Congress. Second, put more accent on youth and new faces in party affairs. Third, build up a better party organization from the ground up. As to the first point, one hears conflicting views expressed among Republicans. There are those who say the party should become more conservative, and its members in Congress should make no compromise with administration proposals. I cannot believe that that would be a wise course. In the first place, I have never heard such views expressed except by persons over 50 years of age. I am sure they're almost universally opposed by the younger members of the party. Now, I'm in the 50 age group myself, but I cannot see much future for any party based upon an appeal directed solely to those in the upper age group. A party which does that is almost dead already. In the second place, to adopt such a policy would be an outright repudiation of the platform upon which all Republican members of Congress were elected. It seems to me that what we should do in Congress is to bend every effort to carry out the provisions of our party platform. It was good at convention time, and it's good now. If the Republican members of the two houses would meet at an early date and go on record as reaffirming the Republican platform and authorize the Republican leaders in Congress to so state, it would be a salutary thing and inspire confidence everywhere. I would follow this up by giving more prominence to younger party members, both in and out of Congress. I'm not suggesting the abolition of the seniority rule until something better comes along, but one of its disadvantages is that it holds back able new men who in many cases are more representative of party thinking and leadership than those who have seniority by reason of the fact that stand-pat Republican districts have returned them year after year. We need greater representation in congressional councils of men who represent marginal districts and who have gotten close to the people because they've had to fight hard for election. Outside of Congress, more attention must be given to those in younger age groups. They should be encouraged to accept and exercise leadership and to become candidates for important offices. This brings me to the question of better party organization from bottom to top. This is particularly important in view of the fact that our loss this year was mostly because our organization didn't function as it should because of overconfidence. The most effective organizations for getting out the vote this year were the labor organizations. Had our party organization been half as effective and enthusiastic, we would have won. Finally, our overall objective must be to convince the voters of this country that the Republican Party is interested in their problems and that voting the Republican ticket will help them to solve these problems. That has always been the basis of political success in this country. These suggestions I have made outline some of the means which I think might be used to attain this objective.
We return you now to New York.
Thank you, Congressman Hope. Senator Flanders, now we have heard from a Middle Western Republican. I'd like to ask you the question, how will a liberal Republican Party be different from a liberal Democratic Party?
That is a good question to ask. And should we use the word liberal as exactly the same with reference to both parties, there would be no difference. But I feel that there is a real difference. The liberal Republican Party will address its legislation and its amendment of pending legislation so that it both serves the needs of the people of the country as a whole and also provides practical and possible means for reaching those needs, attaining those needs, filling them, meeting them. That is the definition of a liberal so far as it applies to our party.
Well, Senator Baldwin, does a liberal Republican Party mean a Me Too party, a New Deal party?
No, I think it does not. I think those are the two, this Me Too idea, we ought to reject. This idea of attempting to outbid the Democrats, we ought to reject. However, there are certain basic things that we can be definitely for and that we can provide specific programs for. For example, take the matter of job security, take the matter of the continuous employment, take the matter of health, take the matter of prices, take any matter that concerns the individual American today. What the Republican Party should do is to formulate programs that can be met within the terms of liberty as we understand it, within the terms of our own economy, and then be for those programs. Now, they may not mean as much in dollars and cents. They may not mean the giving away of so much money. But nevertheless, they should be designed to meet those needs, and we should then be positively for them and try to convince the people that our program is better than the other fellow's program and that it will work.
Senator Baldwin, I think we have a very practical example of the differences you have been describing. When we look at the history of the New Deal legislation and administration between 1932 and 1939, for instance, the New Deal set out to end unemployment. It failed. There were still 8 million unemployed in 1939, and it was only the war which put, and preparation for war, which put an end to unemployment. I am satisfied that had the New Deal concerned itself with the expansion of business and its unemployment opportunities, that problem would have been solved. Furthermore, on the liberal objectives and other lines in which the New Deal set up and which have on the whole been accepted by the American people as desirable, it was able to accomplish them in appearance to some extent only by an enormous expansion of the government debt. That is what I mean by the difference between Democratic and Republican liberalism. Our liberalism must, while directed toward human needs, must also be of the kind that actually accomplishes the end for which we set, and accomplishes it by the expansion of production in this country, which is the only means by which those needs can be satisfied, really, instead of by words.
Well, in other words, you mean the more production we have, the more wealth in the general sense we create, and the better support that we have on a broad basis for all these social objectives of education and health, housing and everything.
They are
but
all
to return
based.
To a specific yeah. example of what I mean by a program and what I mean by liberalism. 2 years ago, or a year ago this past fall, you and I were very much concerned over the matter of high prices. We conducted extensive hearings. We were aware, as many Republicans were aware, of the problems of the people with high prices. You came back to Washington, and together we formulated a program for dealing with that subject of high prices. Unfortunately, I think the Republicans have rejected it. Maybe there were some things that should have been rejected. But we did have an awareness of the problem of high prices, and you particularly, sir, did make a great contribution for a program to deal with it. Now, it would seem to me that would have been a sign of liberalism in this last session of the Congress had we gone forward with that program.
Very naturally, Senator Baldwin, I agree with you. I think that the time was psychologically ripe at that moment for doing something which would have obviated this third round of the spiral of inflation, which is just now being completed.
Senator Baldwin, you've been speaking about the record of the Republican Party in Congress, but another question arises here. The election statistics show that of the 13 cities of over a 500,000 population in the United States, the Republicans in this election were not able to carry a single one. You, sir, come from a heavily urbanized state, and I'd like to ask you the question, how can the Republican Party improve its vote in the big cities? Isn't this at the basis of much of this need for reorganization of party thinking?
May I preface what I'm going to say with this statement? It seems to me it's quite astounding that the Republican strength increased in this last election in New England and in the Middle Atlantic states, which includes the great states of New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. It didn't increase in New York, but it did in the other two, and increased on the Pacific coast in the urban areas. Now, that indicated that Republicans must have had some appeal. Now, I think to broaden that appeal that we have got to have, not a Me Too policy, not an outbidding policy, but we have got to have a program and a policy with reference to labor that's friendly and sympathetic, with reference to industry that's friendly and sympathetic. We've got to have a policy with reference to education and housing and prices and all of these things that concern the people in order to win back the vote of the urban areas, because there's where the great vote is, as you point out. We have got to show an awareness of the problems of the people that live there, a sympathetic interest in those problems, and a sincere desire and a program to deal with their solution.
Senator Flanders, you have been describing a liberal Republican program here, but I gather from what you say that one of the difficult problems is to make Republican liberalism understood by the American people. How do you explain to them what the limitations of our economic system are?
Well, Mr. Horn, that is, of course, a real problem. The most gratifying experience that I had during the recent campaign was in talking to college groups. And my experience during the campaign was almost entirely with the college groups. The students react immediately to anything which realistically shows what means must be taken to make social improvement. I am hopeful that by having meetings with young people the country over, not merely college groups, but in all of the classes of society, that we can, in the same way come to an understanding, a mutual understanding of what is practically necessary for reaching the human aims to which the Republican Party must devote itself.
And Senator, aren't you very much heartened by this open letter that came from the Harvard Young Republican Club, the MIT Young Republican Club, the Radcliffe Young Republican Club, and the Wellesley Young Republican Club? I personally think that's a grand letter and a grand approach, and I feel highly pleased at the interest these young people have shown.
I believe that the future, if we address ourselves to the young people, is clearly a hopeful one, and as you say, nothing more hopeful has come to our public notice than this letter.
I think another thing that's highly pleasing, here's young Philip Wilkie, whose father was one of the great leaders of our times. I think one of the very greatest myself, and he has interested himself in politics. He has made a proposal to the National Committee for the calling of a meeting to discuss Republican policies and program, and I think that's a great thing. I hope the party goes forward with that kind of a meeting.
Gentlemen, you're mentioning some very specific steps here that the Republican Party may take, but perhaps there's another argument sometimes made that we need to take up here. Some people have suggested that Republican prospects for success do not depend so much on the policies of the party as on economic changes within the country. Suppose we had another Great Depression. Would you expect that that automatically would lead to Republican victory?
Mr. Horn, it seems to me that that is not merely a fallacious, but a cynical proposal for Republican success. I don't need to expand on its being cynical. I'd just like to say a word or two about its being fallacious. There is no evidence whatsoever that another depression will not throw us further to the left and further away from the possibility of maintaining the well-being of the citizens of the country. And with that conviction strongly in my mind, and I'm sure in that of Senator Baldwin as well, it becomes the duty of the Republican Party to join with the Democratic Party so far as it is in endeavoring to maintain employment, to maintain production, and to maintain the prosperity and well-being of the American
Senator,
people.
Senator, don't you think one of the best things that we could do in this Congress would be, number one, to propose things on the part of Republicans that are designed to maintain employment at a high level, to maintain production at a high level, to prevent a depression, and secondly, to object and point out as forcefully as we can any policies or programs pursued by the administration that, if continued in their pursuit, would bring on a depression. Don't you think that's one of the great things we can do in this coming Congress?
Senator Baldwin, I feel convinced that we would be committing a shameful suicide if we pursued any other policy whatsoever.
Senator Flanders, we've had a bipartisan foreign policy. We've heard a great deal about it. Would you include frank discussion of the bipartisan foreign policy as a Republican responsibility?
That certainly is a Republican responsibility. It has been in effect, in spite of the talk about the bipartisan policy, it has been in effect in the 2 years in which I have been in Congress. The foreign policy of the nation has been improved by the fact that the Republicans have had a definite part in determining it, and the bipartisan basis, to my mind, begins when the legislation is passed, and from that point on, it is an American policy.
It seems to me that, so far as our foreign policy is concerned, it would not have been and would not be what it is now had it not been for Senator Vandenberg and Republican leadership. And as a matter of fact, the Republicans, and particularly Senator Vandenberg, would have made more of a contribution had they been taken into the councils of the administration as closely as they should have been taken.
I agree completely.
Senator Baldwin, you mentioned Philip Wilkie's proposal for a National Republican Policies Convention. I take it, Senator Flanders, that you would agree with that proposal also.
I likewise agree with that proposal.
And, gentlemen, I believe you mentioned also that the Republican Party should support those proposals of the Truman administration that are in agreement with the Republican Party platform.
After all, Mr. Truman is the president of the American people, and we've got to lend him our loyal, patriotic support. And that support includes pointing out as vigorously and as ably as we can, where we as Republicans think he's wrong. And that's part of our job in the next Congress.
But do you think that the American people have had a chance to learn of the real services of Senator Vandenberg?
I know they have not. I wished in this last campaign that we had spent more time telling about the contribution of Senator Vandenberg and other Republicans in the formation of our Republican policy. Senator Vandenberg made one speech. He should have made many more.
Well, Senator Baldwin, do you agree with the statement in Arthur Crock's column in the New York Times of today that nothing can be expected of significant value from an effort to meet some people's demands that the Republican Party now be reorganized? Mr. Crock argues that in all past elections, the Republican presidents have been elected because of a split in the Democratic Party or the rise of a popular leader like Theodore Roosevelt, or some great change that creates dissatisfaction with the Democrats. Is an effort to reorganize the Republican Party, and by that I mean its leadership, a contradiction to the successful practices of a political party.
Well, Mr. Horne, I should not like to think that the Republican parties can only win by dissatisfaction with the other party in power. I would like to think that the Republican Party must be in the future, as it has been most of the time in the past, a party of constructive, progressive ideas. It's furnished much of that type of leadership in American history.
Senator Flanders, how would you feel about necessary changes in the Republican leadership in Congress?
Those changes, it seems to me, must be made in those cases where leadership has misinterpreted the desires and ideals of the American people, those desires and ideals which can be reached. We can have a better leadership in the party.
Well, gentlemen, I take it from this discussion that you pretty much agree with the remarks of these young Republicans in Massachusetts whose letter you've mentioned. If the present leadership of the Republican Party hopes to attract young men and women of ability and principle, it must rekindle our party's traditional fires of humanitarianism and sincere purpose. We cannot depend upon a Truman Depression for our next political opportunity. We must carve out this opportunity ourselves in a united Republican record in Congress, which will support the next Republican candidate for president. This is the only sure promise of victory.
Thank you, gentlemen. You've been listening to the University of Chicago Roundtable discuss the election and the Republican Party with Raymond E. Baldwin, Republican United States Senator from Connecticut, Ralph E. Flanders, Republican United States Senator from Vermont, Clifford Hope, Republican Congressman from Kansas, and Robert Horn of the Department of Political Science of the University of Chicago as participants. This week's roundtable pamphlet includes the full text of today's discussion, special reading lists, illustrations, and questions for analysis and discussion. You will want to receive this pamphlet and to read these important supplementary materials. Be sure to write for your copy and send 10 cents in coin with your order to the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. For $3, you may subscribe to the pamphlet for a full year and receive 52 weekly issues. I'll repeat that address, the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. Next week, the Roundtable will discuss news about the planets. Today's Roundtable originated in Radio City, New York, and station WDAF, Kansas City, Missouri. The National Broadcasting Company and its independent affiliated stations have cooperated in the presentation of this discussion, which brings to the American listener various shades of opinion on important public issues. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.